From the Sky News Centre at 5, a farmer's finally admitted murdering his wife 4 years ago. Adrian Pratt was convicted of killing Kate last year, but up until now has denied any involvement. He's now taken police to his farm in Gloucestershire. Tom Parmenter reports.
Adrian Pratt was handcuffed as he arrived back on Redhill Farm. 4 years after his wife Kate went missing, he's now finally confessed to her murder. In a police vehicle, he led officers across fields to a wooded area. They have now screened off an old pheasant pen. The search for Kate Prout's body will start next week.
Britain and Germany have agreed to disagree on how best to tackle the Eurozone's debt crisis. David Cameron and Angela Merkel say they've made progress, but admit substantial differences remain. The investigation into the death of Hollywood actress Natalie Wood has been reopened 30 years after she drowned. The captain on the yacht, the West Side Story star, died off in 1981, blames her husband at the time, Robert Wagner, for her drowning. Hugh Grant, Sienna Miller and J.K. Rowling will be among the first witnesses to give evidence to the Leveson inquiry into press standards next week. QPR boss Neil Warnock suggesting a boycott of international games by players in an attempt to force Sepp Blatter out. The FIFA president's refusing to stand down despite being widely criticised for controversial comments on racism. John Solarko is a Nigerian-born ex-England player and an anti-racism campaigner. He's not convinced that refusing to play is the right move.
I think to start talking about boycotting and striking is just going too far. We need the situation dealt with, and that's another thing. You know, we need to deal with things far quicker, get it over and done with. Let's get to the bottom of it and move on.
And scientists are becoming more confident they'll be able to disprove Einstein's theory that nothing can travel faster than light. Italian physicists first made the claim in September, but now have repeated an adapted version of their experiment, which produced the same result. That's the latest. I'm Lindsay Brown.
Community FM is a registered charity, which means we're not for profit. BCFM is the award-winning community radio station for Bristol, and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice. BCFM 93.2. Bristol is our community. Bristol Community FM 93.2.
Hello, Bristol, and welcome to BCFM's politics show, Friday Drive Time. I'm Tony Gosling, and helping us review this week's news is Labour councillor for Staple Hill, Ian Bolton. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, we hear from investigative journalist Laurie Flynn, who published a book, The Untouchables, in 2004, explaining why the Stephen Lawrence case was kicked into the long grass for nearly 20 years, and how police and media corruption, he believes, went all the way to the top. Plus, the former head of MI5 says she wants to decriminalise cannabis so the police can focus on hard drugs associated with burglary and violence. Steve Barker from the Legalised Cannabis Alliance believes cannabis was only up to Class B so the police could divert attention away from arresting crack and heroin dealers, but still tick their boxes. And the 10th Crusade. More noises this week that NATO may attack or invade Syria and Iran. But is this just like the medieval Crusades, a war for plunder under the guise of religion? And are Goldman Sachs financing it all? Professor Anthony Hall's written a new book about propaganda of empire building since 1492, and he believes the formula is essentially the same. Nothing much has changed for the last 400 years. Plus, Eddie James is here to talk about Bristol's great business rate scam. That's in the second hour after six. On to our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Lows of 7 Celsius tonight and dry. This weekend, highs of 13, so mild, reasonably mild anyway for the time of year. Sunnier on Saturday and cloudier on Sunday. Next week, highs 13, staying reasonably mild. A mixture of sunshine and showers, and fairly windy at times. Next weekend, that's the 26th and 27th of November, highs down, down to 10 degrees Celsius, fairly cloudy and windy. That's next weekend. And that was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. And time to introduce this week's guests, and joining us is Labour councillor for Staple Hill, Ian Bolton. Hi, Ian. Welcome to Drive Time.
Thank you very much.
Now, first of all, you are actually a South Gloucestershire councillor, is that right?
That's right, yes.
And what got you into politics?
The big question. It was some time ago that I was looking at taking on an interest that I could really get my teeth into, and I thought that I could get involved in several charities or several single issue causes, and I came to the conclusion that actually these charities and single issue causes, at the end of the day, who are they lobbying? It's the politicians. And I thought, rather than lobbying these people, I could actually get involved where the power seemed to be and do it myself. And that's how I got into it.
That's interesting you say it seemed to be. So have you found difference since you've become a councillor?
Yes, certainly. And also speaking to MPs over the years, you know, one of the things about being a democracy is that the seat of power doesn't necessarily sit with just a small handful of people. We are accountable to the electorate at the end of the day, and things aren't as easy as we might think.
But don't you think politicians are only see themselves as accountable to the electorate in the couple of months running up to an election, and then they just go and do what they want?
They'd be very foolish if they did. Our electorate do have long enough memories to hold a grudge if they feel that they've been dealt with unfairly, and quite rightly so.
Okay, and what was your profession? What were you doing before you got into politics?
Well, I'm still doing it because obviously as a councillor, this is just something that we do part-time. I actually a training and development person, so I run a lot of training courses. So that's how I pay the mortgage.
Okay, and why the Labour Party, not one of the other main parties?
That's an obvious question for me. It's the party that I think has the values that I believe in. It has that sense of social justice that I don't feel the other parties have. It's something I've grown very passionate about.
Well, you say that, but in the last Labour government, we had in central government, we had the biggest increase in inequalities between rich and poor for a long time. And actually, at the beginning of that, 12 years or something of Labour government, we ended up at the end of it with an even bigger divide between rich and poor. So how can you say that's social justice?
They were affluent times, I have to say, under the Labour government, but I also want to point out the child poverty figures actually really improved under Labour in a record way, and I think that's part of our reason to be, is to deal with poverty, and as I say, the child poverty figures showed for themselves.
Now, if you're driving up and down or on the bus between Staple Hill and the city, you come across a big sign saying Bristol, don't you? Is there any real difference, do you think, between the city of Bristol and Staple Hill? Because really there's no kind of gap of fields in between. It's just a continuous load of houses.
I would say yes, actually. Staple Hill has never been in Bristol. And I think a lot of the residents of Staple Hill are very proud of their independence from Bristol. And so we do have to talk closely with our neighbours, but there's a strong character, strong independence in Staple Hill.
So what is the difference in character then?
We are quite a unique place, and you just have to walk up and down the shops, for example. We don't have that many chains in Staple Hill. In fact, I can't think of any major national chains at all in Staple Hill, except for we have a small Tesco store. But apart from that, we have a lot of independent traders, and I think that sums it up. We're very independent.
Okay. Also, Martin Summers is joining me, old Labour Oxford economist. Martin, this week, the crisis is mainly to do with bank debt. How is this affecting the PIGS countries, the debts in those countries? Because this is the sort of alternative to the IMF, isn't it? There's a whole bunch of countries which are really suffering under this euro crisis. I mean, how is it affecting them?
Well, it's obviously affecting them very badly. There's another acronym that's being used for them as well. I can't remember what it is now, but it doesn't matter. I mean, we're talking about Southern Europe, effectively. Well, clearly the crisis keeps moving on. I mean, they used to say a week is a long time in politics. 24 hours is becoming a very long time in economics. We're staring a worldwide banking collapse in the face.
And is the European Central Bank going to step in eventually, do you think, and save the situation?
David Cameron is trying to twist Angela Merkel's arm this afternoon to switch on the money press. I think Angela Merkel is going to say no. And at that point, the markets think she is, but I don't think the Germans are. It's against the Lisbon Treaty. The Bundesbank are against it. Her party's against it. Germany's public opinion is right against it.
But if the Germans don't do something, they're not going to be very popular, are they?
No, but I think the Germans are right not to say at this stage of the game, we're not throwing good money after bad. Yeah, basically.
Well, the Chinese, when they came along a couple of weeks ago, they shook their heads at the whole thing and said, we're not having anything to do with
it. That's because basically the banks are bust. And if we're talking about the banks being bust, we're talking about Wall Street and the City of London. And basically Britain has tried to lecture Germany for the last 30, 40 years about what they should and shouldn't do and how they needed to do this and do that. The Germans just shook their heads and ignored them whilst they were absorbing East Germany, which, of course, if it had happened to Britain, we'd have sunk without trace under the Atlantic. And basically the Germans have got their history and tradition as well, and they're not to be bullied about this. They won't be bullied about it, and the markets will have to suck on it.
So what would you do if you were over there? What would be your advice? Would you look at something like a two-track euro, or would you advise these PIGS countries? I mean, we just had Spain as well adding itself to the previous list of Greece and Italy, now having a bit of a crisis. Is it better for these countries to go back to their original currencies, or should there be maybe a two-track euro?
Well, I understand the discussions at the top are about a hard euro, or basically possibly a Deutschmark zone, and leave all these other countries in the euro. I mean, the Germans made a big mistake when they absorbed East Germany, which I mentioned earlier, which is they had a one-to-one exchange of Ostmarks for Deutschmarks, which meant that basically people in the East got a massive windfall immediately, yeah? But at the same time, of course, they then priced themselves out of jobs, and people are still unemployed in East Germany, living on that benefits all this time later because of that decision. And the Germans are beginning to really, I mean, I think the euro, unfortunately, is going to break up because there's not enough flexibility in the system. But that, of course, is not a euro problem, as the Tory euro sceptics seem to think. It's going to hit the City of London like a kick in the knackers.
Well, we've already had this £750 billion quantitative easing QE2. Now, that is going to the banks rather than, as again on Question Time last night was pointed out, I think it was by Simon Jenkins, that, you know, why can't we spend this into the economy? Why can't we use this money to build houses or something like that? But the banks, even though they've had this money, are still complaining. We had this week some comments from the chief executive of RBS Retail, Brian Hartzer. So let's have a listen to him.
Well, banking's never been free. I mean, banks are expensive to run. We've got, for us, we've got over 2,000 branches. We've got 27,000 people. We've got online banking, mobile phone banking, ATMs. These things are expensive. The computer system is expensive. So it's actually a myth. And in fact, that myth about free banking is part of why we've had all the issues we've had over the last decade. My observation coming from overseas is it creates this perverse incentive where you have to create cross subsidies because you have to get the revenue from somewhere. And that, I think, leads to a lack of transparency. And it also, of course, leads to a real challenge around competition, which people complain about. But if you've created a business system where a new bank can't come in and make any money, and at the moment, because interest rates are so low, you know, effectively zero, banks don't get any value from the deposits, particularly. They have to make it up in other ways.
That was the chief executive of RBS Retail, Brian Hartzer. A few of these chief executives have been popping their heads above the parapet recently. Martin, he's saying there basically that the situation now is that the banks are so impoverished and it's not a very good business to make money at, that it looks like they're going to have to, well, they're stopping new people coming into the market. So there won't be any new banks to replace some of these old dinosaurs because there's not enough money to be made in banking. And also that it may be the end of free banking.
Well, I mean, I think as a retail bank head, he's got some case to make there because retail banks are being dragged down by the failures of the investment banking arm of RBS, for example. And the fact of the matter is, as he's just admitted, RBS is basically bust if you look through the books properly, just as they all are. And they've been bust all along. And we've been chucking money at them in order to sort themselves out for 4 years. They haven't sorted themselves out. This will be the German position, as I said earlier. They haven't sorted themselves out. We're not chucking any more money at this. That means that they will have to go down. And just on RBS, it's been sold at a loss to Richard Branson, who's
Not RBS. That's Northern Rock.
Northern Rock. Okay. I stand corrected.
Okay, Ian, can I just bring you in on this? What are your thoughts about some of what we've been hearing about the banking crisis, the euro crisis? What's your take on it all?
Well, the banking crisis is interesting. When you talk about Northern Rock there, what a terrible time to sell a bank, given everything you're saying there. And it's no wonder that they've managed to buy Northern Rock from the government for a knockdown price, causing a huge loss to us as taxpayers. It just beggars belief as far as I'm concerned.
So what would you have done?
I would have held on to it until we get better value for our money. I mean, you hear the chief exec of Virgin saying that in the long term we will get our money back. Well, we'd have got the money back and still owned it on the discussion she's been having with the press over the last couple of days. So I think we should have held on to it and sold high rather than sold low as we did yesterday.
But Martin, going back to what Brian Hartz was saying, do you think that this is an inevitable consequence of this crisis, that the banks are going to start charging us for using cash points and cheques and all these kind of things?
They're
talking about, for example, in Australia, many of the bank accounts there, you have to pay something like $5 per month just to have a bank account.
Well, I think ultimately we're going to move towards a state-run system. I don't agree with Ed Balls that we are going to use the money we get from selling high rather than low to pay down the debt. The fact of the matter is the banking system is bust. They are zombie banks. Just we've had zombie banks in Japan for the last 10 years. Our banks are zombie banks.
Well,
we are never going to sell them back to the private sector.
How can these zombies carry on walking?
They carry on walking because the taxpayer carries on giving them more money to waste. And what we've got to do is actually assert control over the banking system. That's what should have happened in 2008. If you're going to bail them out, we should take over. What's wrong with a publicly run banking system run for public benefit? Is that so bad? That's what Iceland used to have before 2003, when these shysters turned up and said, hey, why don't we privatise? That's perfectly viable. Well, if you've got a well-run state-run banking system, one of the problems is it undercuts the private banking system completely, which is why they've got EU rules about it and so on. Properly run state-run banks actually are more efficient, and that's where we need to go.
Okay, well, the governor of the Bank of England, King Mervyn, became a sir this week, so that makes him Sir King, and we have now to bow even lower in his presence. But more importantly, what did he have to say when he gave his latest report on our economy this week?
The journey to a more balanced world economy will be long and arduous. The immediate impact of the decline in sentiment is that the outlook for growth of the world economy has worsened since August. That is also true here in the United Kingdom, where activity could be broadly flat until around the middle of next year. We continue to face a difficult economic environment. The committee's judgment about the outlook for fourth quarter GDP growth is summarised in chart 1 on page 6 of the report. It's based on the assumption that bank rate follows a path implied by market interest rates and that the stock of purchased assets financed by the issuance of central bank reserves increases over the next 3 months to £275 billion, remaining constant thereafter.
Martin, could you translate a bit of that? He's basically saying...
It's like criminology, isn't it? What does he really mean by that?
Yeah, he's saying that the recovery is going to be long and arduous, and he's also saying that this is going to, ultimately they're going to try and rebalance the world economy. Now, what does that actually mean, rebalancing the economy?
Well, what it really means, rebalancing the world economy, means that China should have more internal demand and not rely upon selling cheap tat to us. And we should export more manufactured goods. But this is all a wish list. It's too late for that. He's a central banker. So what he's saying is, if a central banker says that the economy's dead in the water, that means we're going to have a crash. Because in actual fact, that's what will happen. If the world economy stalls, it doesn't just stall. All of these credit default swaps are then activated and the banks go down. And that's what's going to happen. Now, Mervyn King is not going to say that because he can't say that as Britain's central banker. If he goes out there and says panic, everybody's going to run for the exits. So it's his job to be emollient. And he's being as emollient as he can be. We're dead in the water, but we're actually just dead.
Ian, before we look at some of the symptoms of the economic situation at the moment, can you just give us your take on how you think the Chancellor should be dealing with this, George Osborne?
Well, all the way along, we've been talking about how we should grow our way out of the crisis that we're in now rather than cut our way out of it. So it should be investing in local manufacturing, local businesses, local services. You think of how some of the, I'm no economist, but you think of how some of the serious issues that the world has faced over the last 100 years have actually been helped by investing in those services and building our way out of that.
So. But where are you going to get that money from? You're going to have to borrow it. That's going to increase the deficit. That's going to up the, lower really, Britain's credit rating. It's going to mean we have to pay more. We're going to become like Italy or Greece.
But don't forget that only this week it's been announced that the Tory government government are actually going to have to now borrow more than the Labour government was predicted to borrow anyhow. So, you know, we are in a worse position as far as our economy is concerned, and we're borrowing more than was ever predicted. So I stick by the argument that we went into the last general election with.
Now, I'm very pleased to say Marina Morris is back after a couple of months of absence. Marina, what have you got for us today?
National Statistic. This Wednesday, the Office for National Statistic released dire UK unemployment number showing that in the quarter to September 2011, unemployment rose at the fastest rate for 17 years. Total unemployment fell sharply, and the number of young people aged between 16 and 24 out of work broke the politically sensitive 1 million barrier. Nationally, in the period from July to September 2011, the employment rate for those aged from 16 to 64 was 70.2%, down 0.4% on the quarter. There were 29 million people in employment aged 16 and over, down 197,000 on the quarter. The unemployment rate was 8.3% of economically active population. It is the highest since 1996, and the number of unemployed people is the highest since 1994. The inactivity rate for those aged from 16 to 64 was 23.3%, up 0.1% on the quarter. There were 9.36 million economically inactive people aged from 16 to 64, up 64,000 on the quarter. Locally in the Southwest region, 2.5 million people were in employment. Unemployment was 178,000, 6.6% of the workforce, or 1 in 15. 6.6% in the Southwest compares to the highest unemployment rate in the country experienced in the Northeast of 11.6% and is close to the lowest regional statistic in the Southeast of 6.3%. In summary, the national figure are dire, especially in the northeast of England. Unemployment in the southwest remains relatively stable, slowly deteriorating, and lower than the national average. With the sluggishness of domestic demand, unemployment, particularly in the young, looks like it will remain a significant issue for the near future.
Marina Morris, thanks very much. Now, Ian Bolton, you are a Labour councillor for Staple Hill. Can you give us your reaction to this? I mean, this whole thing of passing the million mark of unemployed people between 16 to 24, I mean, surely this is pretty concerning, because this is our future we're talking about here.
Absolutely, and this is potentially another lost generation. I'm 43. I can just remember being at school and finding work under the last Tory government, and it's going back in time. It's just so tragic that these opportunities are being lost, because at that age, that's when your path is being set. And if you are subject to long-term unemployment at such a formative age, it's a huge waste.
But at the end of the day, I mean, the banking system is in crisis. It's very difficult for the banks to lend to businesses. And so what can be done to actually get young people back to work, to give them opportunities to express themselves, to actually get involved in work in the future?
Well, I think the apprenticeship scheme is really useful. I mean, it's something that, if you think back 10, 15 years ago, apprenticeships were really rare. It was something that people felt it was a thing of the past. And now apprenticeships are becoming more and more common. It's recognizing that the sort of vocations that require apprenticeship are highly skilled and often very well paid occupations. And so I think that's a way of encouraging employers to take on apprentices is going to be really important, given what we've just heard.
Martin, what do you think is the reason for this big leap in youth unemployment, and what will the consequences be, and what are the consequences?
Well, one of the reasons is macroeconomic errors by George Osborne. Well, there was room for manoeuvre. The Labour Party were quite right at the last election to suggest we could. I mean, basically, people are, the interest rates are at an all-time low. The government could borrow money. The British government could borrow money to invest. But ultimately, of course, we've got, it's about a struggle about power and wealth distribution in the society. The top people in the 1950s in Britain paid 19.6 in the pound tax rates. That sounds impossible.
It was that, the same. Is that about 20%, is it? I
think. No, that's
19
shillings. 19 and 6 in the pound. Yeah.
Oh, right, hang on. That's 95%.
And in the US it was 91%. And you've got to remember that in the 1950s, people had been through World War II, and people understood that if you're going to have resources to provide apprenticeships and what have you, the people at the top have got to pay their whack. And in actual fact, the economy in Britain and the US during that period zinged along. There was full employment. You could leave a job in the morning and find another one in the afternoon. As Harold Macmillan said, who's the Tory Prime Minister of Britain, to the working class, he said, "You've never had it so good." And he was right. And I don't think that Harold Macmillan, for example, as a Conservative, would have been cutting public expenditure at this moment. The Conservative Party used to understand how silly that was.
We were talking about the quantitative easing, this wonderfully termed QE2 earlier on. Why is it then that that money is being given to these banks? You say that it's only just basically going to prop them up for another few months, rather than actually spent directly into the economy.
Absolutely.
Through the Treasury.
If you think about it, the cuts that have been brought in since the Conservatives came to power, and even the talk of cuts, has stalled the economy. So now we've got to print some funny money to bail the banks out, because we've taken the real money out of the economy. Now what you need to do is put the real money back in and switch off the printing press. And we're not going to spend our way out. We're going to tax our way out. We're going to get hold of the people who live in the comfortable parts of Britain and give them a kicking, because they've done very well out of the last 30 years, very well, and it's time for the breakages to be paid for. And if they don't like that, they can leave the country, but they're not coming back. That's not official Labour policy, that's me.
Okay, Martin, thank you. Now, moving on to some local stories, and we heard last month that Filton Airfield, even though British Aerospace are planning to close it and saying that it's not making any money, was actually in £1.3 million profit last year. That's the airfield near Bristol that's been earmarked for closure, because its owners claim it's not economically viable. And apparently, according to the BBC, this article wasn't in the Evening Post, just on the BBC. It made a £1.3 million profit in 2010. Martin Farmer from the Save Bristol Filton Airfield campaign said, "They're misleading local people. As a campaign group, we're not surprised, and we never have believed the spin that they're losing £3 million a year." He added that he believed the airfield had a viable future if another operator came in and took over the operation. A spokesman for BAE Systems said, "As the owner and operator, BAE Systems has repeatedly said the airfield has been loss-making." So, Ian, what's your, as a South Gloucestershire councillor, what's your view on this one?
Well, Filton Airfield, we believe, is of certainly regional importance, if not national importance. And so even though I'm not a Filton councillor, Staple Hill is within South Gloucestershire, but this is, I think everyone involved in the region should be concerned about this. And we are the home of British aviation, and we've had the aviation industry working there for the last 101 years. And to lose the runway for the British home of aerospace, leaving it landlocked, is counterintuitive, to say the very least.
But I mean, isn't it simple facts that they've made at £1.3 million profit per year, or they've made it just this year, British Aerospace, but they can see that there's a massive demand for housing right now, and that actually the airfield is much more valuable as housing land than it is with a runway, a piece of tarmac that's used a few times a day.
Now that's the point I would argue, that I don't think it's more valuable as housing. It's a vital part of the infrastructure of the Southwest, and though we all agree we need more housing, that is not the place to put it.
But in a capitalist economy, where we still are a capitalist country, I believe, it's up to British Aerospace to do what they want with it. It's their piece of land, and they, to them, on their books, it's much more valuable to sell it to housing developers.
Well, I just hope that your next-door neighbours don't go by that policy and build something that you don't find attractive next to your home, because actually we have planning regulations to ensure that we have a healthy infrastructure and that these things are well thought out. So, as recently as March, South Gloucestershire Council confirmed that the runway was a vital part of our infrastructure and should be safeguarded. And the only thing that has changed is that in April, BAE Systems said that they wanted to close it to build on it. That's the only thing that has changed since it was confirmed in March it needed to be safeguarded.
BAE Systems used to belong to the British government. It's now become a privately run corporation driven by profit. In actual fact, of course, most of their contracts are with the military-industrial complex here and in the United States. So although they're privately run and private profits are made, most of their money still comes from the taxpayer. In Germany or Japan, they would not be closing that airfield. They've got a long-term plan, a long-term view. The idea that our aerospace company, chief aerospace company, wants to build houses is just a joke.
Now, the local MP there, Jack Lopresti, he's very much saying, he's come out really in favour of British Aerospace, saying he does not support the campaign to save the airfield. So, I mean, he's quite clearly a very influential chap around those parts. And who are you to disagree with the local MP, Ian?
Well, I do represent my own residents, and only recently in the Bristol Evening Post they ran a poll asking the question about whether we should save it, and actually 93% of residents that responded to this poll said that we should save the airfield. So I am at a loss as to the position that Jack has taken here, and I'm sure you'll want to ask him his reasons for it, because I don't
understand. You were the candidate standing against it at the last election, were you not?
Well, yes, I mean, we have actually invited Jack on this programme three times, and he's booked in three times and then cancelled three times so far, but we'll keep trying.
Good luck.
see if we can get him on to chat about Filton, because I think it's very, very important site for the future of the city and certainly industry. And if the thing is, if it's all housing, then you've got yourself basically a ghetto with no jobs.
And also, you need to think about the infrastructure that there is already. I mean, if anyone has been out to the Cribbs Causeway area around Christmas time and seen the gridlocks that are there. Now, if this is built on with 3,500 houses, let's say an average of two cars each, that's another 7,000 cars in the area, I think every day will be Christmas in that area. Well, I may not want every day as Christmas. I think most people won't want every day as Christmas. He seems to want every day to be Christmas Day.
But that doesn't really figure on the British Aerospace or Jack Lopresti's radar, does it?
No, and we could look at all sorts of conspiracy theories here. You can look at the Safe Filton Airfield Facebook page. There's all sorts of discussions going on there. But don't forget that the developers have funded the Conservative Party very well. There's an article from, I think it's the Telegraph, that's on there at the moment. I think £4 million has been given by property developers to the Conservative Party. I don't know what's been going on in the back rooms here, but it makes no sense, the position he's been taking.
Okay, on to a related story. The Ministry of Defence have been spending £564 million of their equipment budget on consultants, we hear this week. Defence officials spent £564 million earmarked for equipment on actually just individual consultants. It emerged on Friday, today. An internal audit of defence contracts since 2009 found civil servants made little attempt to seek value for money. This is one of the Guardian newspapers' investigative reports. This was a sharp rise from 2005, where the MOD spent just £6 million on technical support. The Guardian said the increase was partly due to rules introduced by Labour in 2009, allowing senior defence officials to hire specialist help on some projects without authorisation from a minister. So a sort of arm's length Ministry of Defence. Martin, do you want to start on this one? It looks like money that's supposed to be going to equipment is not. It's going to sort of management consultants and various kinds of little advisers running around inside the Ministry of Defence.
And a wider issue is the privatisation of the military, full stop, so that we've got probably more private contractors in Afghanistan than we've got actual serving British soldiers. Don't forget that war is a profitable business for some. And there's always a problem with the military-industrial complex, as President Eisenhower pointed out in the United States. You know, once you've got a big interest that wants lots of money spent on weapons, they then get the money and make a profit, and then they lobby for more of the same. And we end up throwing our good money after bad, invading foreign countries and all the rest of it. There's lots of waste, and a lot of it is in the Ministry of Defence. We actually need a proper Ministry of Defence, not a Ministry of Invasions.
Now, yes, or Ministry of War, yes. Ian, what's your thoughts on this? Because it seems that it echoes of the Border Agency story as well here, where actually a lot of activity that these ministries are supervising is at arm's length. It's a little bit too far away from the eyes of the minister.
Mm. I mean, I'm particularly interested when they put this back to the Labour government and the rules introduced by Labour. But there's a different ideology in power now. I think of, it goes back to what we were saying just now about growing our way out of the economy. As I said earlier, that I'm in training and development, and I know through the last downturn there was a huge investment in training and development, and this happened in the public sector, that you trained people up to do the jobs. So you didn't have to recruit people in from outside. You didn't have to pay money on consultants. And that was an active policy. Here, to blame the rules that were introduced in 2009 and then carry on increasing the amount of money that's spent on consultants is absolutely crazy. There are cuts being made. They should be training up the people who are facing redundancy to do these jobs. And it's a travesty that that's not happening.
Moving on to another local story. 11 open spaces could be saved, but 38 others face being sold off. Now, I've been in touch with Mark Weston from Bristol Conservative Party, who's found it impossible to come on this show the last few months because he's been going to these meetings every Friday evening to decide what to do about Bristol's open spaces. So an escape route anyway has emerged, according to the Evening Post, to save 11 open spaces in Bristol from the bulldozer. But a big question mark still hangs over the future of a further 38 sites in the City Council's controversial open spaces strategy. There was very strong feelings right across the city about this idea of selling off bits of parks and open spaces. A working party was set up 4 months ago to carry out a review of the planned sell-off, arguing 11 of the most controversial sites should be referred back to the city's neighbourhood partnerships for recommendations about their future. Well, the working party was split, though, over what to do about the remaining 38 less controversial sites. Two of the members, Labour councillor Ron Stone and Tory councillor Mark Weston, wanted all of the sites to go back to the partnerships, that is, for local people to make a decision about whether to dispose of the sites or not. But Liberal Democrat councillor Gary Hopkins and Green councillor Tess Green thought there had been enough discussion about them and they should therefore be reconfirmed as surplus sites to be sold off. The split means that a meeting of the full council next Tuesday will have to make a decision. But given the political split in the working party, it's highly likely that Labour and Tory councillors will join forces to outvote the ruling Liberal Democrats. The Green Party has only two members. Whatever the decision the full council makes, the issue will still have to be signed off by the ruling Lib Deb cabinet. It would be foolhardy, says the Evening Post, for the cabinet to go against the wishes of the council because it might trigger a vote of no confidence and oust the Lib Dems from power. Martin, I mean, you've been with us here covering this story over the last year or so, the attempted sell-off of bits of parks and green spaces around the city, and it looks like it's all coming to a head next Tuesday.
Yes, and the politics of it are quite strange as well, with the Greens and the Liberals lining up against Labour and the Tories.
I was really
this only in Bristol.
Very, very surprised to see the Greens
taking this position. I mean, what I've said before is that when we've had people, you know, vox pops and so on out in the city and talk to people, people can't understand why very valued local spaces, because they usually are very valued by the people who live near them, are being sold off. And we've got lots of brownfield sites which have been the eyesores for years, and the planning regulations don't allow the local council to do anything about those. Now, of course, that's because the planning system is absolutely messed up in favour of developers and all the rest of it. We shouldn't have to be... And Gary Hopkins has been on this show, and he said that this is not a financial decision. This is because, I mean, there was supposedly a consensus about it amongst all the parties that in order to upgrade the main parks, they'd need to sell off some of the smaller bits so they could upgrade the main parks, perhaps put new swings in or whatever. But of course, what they hadn't taken account of is that those little bits of green, which are at the end of somebody's street, are probably as valuable to the people in that street as a big park with facilities. And I don't think people in Bristol in general want any of their parks to be lost. We're a very green city, and we're rather proud of it. And the general public opinion, as you saw, we had Tory and Labour activists on here, both fulminating against it in coalition. It's a very interesting one, but I think ultimately we've got to change the rules of the game.
So, Ian, I know you're not a Bristol City Councillor, but what's the view from down on high up in Staple Hill?
Well, it is interesting looking in on this. We haven't had to face this yet in South Gloucestershire. The thing I'm interested in is how 11 of the most controversial sites should be referred back. And I'm wondering if these are the neighbourhoods where you have well-organised and communities that have shouted loudest. I'm really concerned about the other communities that are losing green space and maybe more vulnerable communities that haven't been able to organise themselves in this way.
What Martin was saying about the brownfield sites? Because you would think that when you've got sites which have been derelict, some of these industrial estates have got sites there have been derelict for 10 years or so, that these are the most sensible ones to be developing, not bits of parks.
Absolutely. And with the planning rules that are being introduced by central government, there's going to be even less incentive to develop the brownfield sites. Brownfield sites often need to be decontaminated. They all sorts of different issues, and this is why we do feel that the green belt that does affect South Gloucestershire could be seriously at threat with the situation that we're facing.
So, what are the new changes that are coming in at the moment then that make it less likely for brownfield sites to be developed on top of all this?
Well, I suppose the most important thing is that there's going to be a predetermination, if you like, that in favour of developers. And they talk about this localism and that people will be able to speak up and organise themselves, but there are going to be so many holes in this, it's going to be toothless, and it's something that we're all really concerned of. There was a lot of posturing that went on during the election. I was at public meetings myself where some of the Conservative candidates, I can think of one in particular, stood up and read out a letter to the public meeting from their spokesperson at the time saying that the Green Belt will be safe. He doesn't seem to be so keen to read out this letter now from the same individuals. They seem to be backtracking on this.
Martin, once again, how can we actually get sensible development, that is to say, on existing derelict sites rather than taking over parks?
We've got to change the rules for property development just as we've got to change the rules for banking. And as we go into a major crisis with mass unemployment, we're going to start asking for more things than we've been asking for years. That will require a change of thinking in the leadership of the Labour Party, but they will have to rise to that challenge.
Okay, on to our next story, and it's a week pretty much now since Remembrance Sunday and Armistice Day, and I came across quite an interesting article in a Toronto magazine, of course in Canada they celebrate these days as well, about the contrast between the righteousness or otherwise of the present wars and the same, and comparing those to the First World War and the Second World War. Maybe you can start on this one, Martin. What are your thoughts about the idea of having one Remembrance Sunday with the Afghanistan and Iraq, these kinds of crises, and actually equating those with World War II?
I think what you've got to remember about Remembrance Sunday is it's not in glorification of Britain's great victories in war. In the 1990s, the Conservative government wanted to have a celebration of D-Day on the 50th anniversary because they thought it would give everybody a holiday and they might get elected and it would be popular. And they went to the British Legion and said, hey, we've got an idea, why don't we have a 50th anniversary holiday for D-Day? And the British Legion, to their great credit, said no, no, no. We're not in the business of celebrating Britain's victories. This is in remembrance of all those who died. Whether it was the First World War, which many people think was a total waste, or the Second World War, which many more people think was good, or the war in Afghanistan today, which the majority of the British people are opposed to. But those who die in the war, sent there by our politicians, we should remember them. And that doesn't mean that people support or don't support the war. That's what Remembrance Sunday is about.
So, Ian Bolton, what are your thoughts on this one? Because it's quite a sensitive subject. We're remembering the fallen, but is it fair to compare the rights and wrongs of Afghanistan with the rights and wrongs of World War II?
Well, it's in the years that the Legion has been in existence, there's only been one year, by coincidence the year I was born, 1968, where we've had no soldiers die in active service. And I think it would be wrong to pick and choose from the other 89 years which which campaigns we choose to mark on Remembrance Day. So I think it's something that everyone clearly understands, and I don't think we need this.
And isn't it? Do you not see that the modern day remembrance services and the Armistice Day service as a kind of endorsement of our policies in Afghanistan and Iraq?
No, I don't see that, and I know that all the way through the history, as I say, if we take the history of the Legion, you know, there have been discussions and debates at that time, and history has looked kindly on the servicemen and women who we do mark and remember on Remembrance Day. So no need, I think, to pick and choose, as I say, which campaigns we support and on Remembrance Day.
Martin, I mean, we had on Channel 4 News, for example, last week a lady who's in her over 100 years old, who's very much an anti-Iraq and anti-Afghanistan campaigner and anti-war campaigner.
I think I saw a speech in Trafalgar Square a few weeks ago.
That's right, yeah. What are your thoughts about this? Because, I mean, this is one of the things this article is saying, is that this Remembrance Service and the Armistice Day is becoming a bit of a sort of pro, almost like a pro-war propaganda.
Well, I tell you what is pro-war propaganda: Help for Heroes, because that's definitely focused by the Murdoch press only on current serving personnel.
Well, in a way, Help for Heroes has arrived as a kind of competition with the British Legion.
Absolutely, they are a counter-gang to the British Legion. If some of our listeners will know what a counter-gang is. I think that the British people understand clearly what Remembrance Sunday is about. It's about remembering the fallen. And in actual fact, many of the service people I speak to are totally opposed to our current wars, but they go anyway because that's their job. And we should remember what the sacrifices they are making, and perhaps we shouldn't start so many wars.
Thank you, Martin. Now, TV licensing workers are on their third round of strikes today. They say conditions have worsened considerably since the BBC outsourced their jobs to Capita.
My name's David Wilshire. I'm the branch secretary of the Communication Workers Union in Bristol. Our members in the TV licensing section who work for a company called Capita are out on strike over what they see as an inadequate pay rise. They haven't had a pay rise for 2 years, and the company has imposed a pay rise against the wishes of everybody working there. A pay rise has been imposed that works out at around about 2.6% over the 2 years.
And that's not bad, because a lot of people at the moment are having to face pay freezes.
Capita are a FTSE 100 company. They're not a company that are broke. They're a company that's making £1 million profit a day. Their profits for the first half of this year were up by 7% on last year, enough to reward some of the directors with a £5,000 pay increase. That generosity hasn't flowed through to the people that work for them, the people that are making the profits, who they're offering a below inflation pay deal to. Capita are a company that are they run, amongst other things, the congestion charge. They apply that. They've had this contract in for the TV licensing for the best part of 9 years now, and are now starting to show their true colours to the people that work for the company, hence the reason why we've had a strike that in this particular part of what used to be the post office is unprecedented.
Capita can quite easily put off each TV licence application and the processing the money until the next day. It's not really going to have much of a real effect, is it?
Well, Capita have got service level agreements with the BBC, and they're currently bidding for the contract, and the result of those bids and whether they're the preferred bidder are due over the next couple of days. But the fact of the matter is that it will hurt them if they're not hitting the targets, particularly in light of the fact that they're trying to seek the contract and renew the contract for, I think it's a further 10 years. Capita are a company that actually have done well out of the recession because of the nature of the contracts they take on, the local government contracts. So they're a company that has bucked the trend. And furthermore, we disagree that just because some groups of workers have accepted a pay freeze, everybody should accept a pay freeze. We don't agree that we should be like dialing down to the lowest common denominator involved in a race to the bottom. And quite frankly, the fact that these people are standing up for themselves and standing up and saying this pay rise that is half the rate of inflation is not acceptable. This company that is a profitable company are treating people differently depending on whether you're a director or somebody who's involved in making the profits is just not acceptable. And I think that's something that we should be doing, not just in this company, but throughout the wider society. where people have gone on strike, they're being refused overtime, and yet the person sat next to them who maybe hasn't supported all the strikes are being offered overtime. It's double standards. They are starting to introduce, in our view, a culture that verges on bullying and harassment to the people that are on strike, and that is why people are so resolute and that people are going to be in this for the long haul.
Whereabouts is the TV licensing centre in Bristol?
Well, we've got two sites in Bristol. We've got a site at the Pithay, which is a smaller mailroom site, and then we've got the big site, which involves a paper-based and email operation, as well as a call centre that's based at the end of Victoria Street, although the address is 100 Temple Street.
That's the Branch Secretary of Communication Workers Union, Dave Wilshire, there. Sorry for the little interruption before that. But Ian Bolton, Labour Councillor of Staple Hill, can you tell us what you think about this? This is Capita. This is the company that's now running quite a lot of our public services. And this is the third day of strikes. But apparently they're going to stick it out for the long run because they want roughly inflation pay increase. Mm. While other people, though, are having pay freezes.
Well, I've always been surprised at the argument that the private sector can do things better than the public sector. At the end of the day, it's down to having effective management, and perhaps that's where the public sector has gone wrong sometimes, by not having effective management. But this could be done within the public sector. As the commentator said, as the man said, you know, Capita is a profitable company and they can afford these, and inflation is high. They have actually had a cut in pay compared to inflation, and so whilst Capita can afford to look after their staff, they should be doing that.
I think that's absolutely right, and I think it's obviously the case that these ex-post office workers have still got a sense of solidarity with each other, and they know how to stop people bullying them around, and we need to see more of that spirit.
Now, the turnover for the financial information on Capita for the 2011 half year report was up by 3% at 1.4 billion, underlying profits up 8% at £193 million profits. I'm so surely Capita can afford to pay a bit of a pay increase.
Absolutely. So we know where their profits are earned from. It's off the backs of their staff.
Well, also, of course, it's earned off the back of the people, because why are public services being given to these private enterprises to make a profit from? They were public in the first place because we didn't want people profiteering on the back of them.
Okay, now another news story, and it's not often that Gloucestershire hits the headlines, and it has this week because the courts in London have ruled that library closures in Gloucestershire and in Somerset are unlawful. Campaigners attempting to stop the closure of the local libraries won a surprise victory in the High Court on Wednesday when a judge ruled the decision to axe services in Gloucestershire and Somerset was unlawful and should be quashed. So it sounds to me, Ian, like your council has been acting unlawfully by trying to close libraries.
That's Gloucestershire Council that has been acting unlawfully. South Gloucestershire, and actually we're very proud of our library service, and at present there have been no threats to any of the library services that we have. So
have Gloucestershire County Council, have they actually got bad lawyers that don't know the law, or what?
I think, again, looking as an outsider into what they've been doing, they just haven't been planning ahead. They haven't been preparing themselves for the downturn compared to South Gloucestershire, where we have been investing in our library service. I mean, people that visit Staple Hill will know that we have a brand new library. It's fantastic. It's used as a hub for the community, and this opened, let me think, it must be only in the last year or so. And we've actually got some savings in there because we've got rid of the old premises that we were renting privately. So I think with Gloucestershire and maybe with Somerset, they just weren't thinking ahead.
But what about this whole idea of whether you actually, when councils are making decisions about cuts, surely they have to have internal lawyers or even bring in lawyers to look at whether what they're doing is legal.
And I agree, and I'm as flummoxed as you are with this.
Libraries, especially at a time of mass unemployment, are centres for community life. And the kind of public spaces that people can use as public spaces are being squeezed down all the time. And especially if we're going to have hard times, which we are, even if we change the government tomorrow, we're going to have hard times. then people need the support of things like libraries, the infrastructure of civilization. I love my local library. I'm in there every 3 weeks changing my books. I'm a history person. I read all the latest history books, fresh, stop off the press, which I couldn't possibly afford to buy. And for me, it's a fantastic resource. It's a we should be investing in the good things in our community. That's the way out of the recession.
But why are we in the situation where councils are actually, when they're coming to making decisions about cuts, actually breaking the law?
Because in actual fact, a lot of the people running the show are not as smart as they think they are. Look at central government.
Okay, on to our next story. And woeful Zurich insurance. Labour MP Lammy talks about the riots and he says that people are still destitute. My experience with Zurich as well, I mean, this is me, Tony, my personal experience is that they are pretty ruthless people. But Mr. Lammy was taking part in a live audience debate in North London on BBC Radio 5 Live. And he said that people are still standing destitute after the riots over the summer. He said there have been a quicker response to an overseas disaster than there has been in Tottenham. He described the response of insurance companies, particularly Zurich Insurance, as woeful. So why is it after these riots, Ian, that we're having such a dreadful response from our insurance firms?
Well, it's interesting that Zurich has been picked out here. I think many of us, when we're looking to renew our insurance policies, now go on the comparison sites, and you'll see that most of these insurance companies are pretty much the same when it comes to the premium. And the thing that will differentiate between them is their customer service. And I think that Zurich have made a big mistake here because of reputational risk. If this gets out, I wouldn't want to go to them. You know, this is going to be important that insurance companies deal with the claims fairly and quickly, because that is what will determine their future viability as companies, is that customer service element. They're missing a trick here by behaving in such a bad way.
Well, I noticed when this story came out at the beginning of this week, there was an instant response from Zurich, who got press releases out all over the Western world, pretty much, saying, or certainly in the UK, denying anything to do with this, but certainly the reports from the local MP, Mr. Lammy, were from individual people that Zurich had been one of the worst insurance companies in actually paying out. So it's all very well to be paying your premiums, but then when you need to cash your insurance money in, or your policy in, they're finding certain companies just aren't delivering the goods. Martin?
Well, this is like payment protection insurance and all the nonsense that went on around that. Which I did some research on for Bristol Debt Advice Centre, if you remember, Tony. I think the other thing, I read a very interesting article today about what actually happened in Tottenham in August, and they were written by two psychology professors, and they've actually interviewed a lot of people, and they said, look, you've got to look at the way the events developed here. There was a shooting of Mark Duggan, which many local people thought was an assassination by the local police. There was a policeful march to the police station, which was not met by a senior police officer. It was actually met by people in riot gear who started pushing the crowd. And that's where it all kicked off.
Well, there was also the fact that it was announced by the police that Mark Duggan actually fired a shot at one of the police officers.
Which was shown to be rubbish afterwards.
Which were then later proved to be
a lie. Well, even the Metropolitan Police themselves said that they'd failed by not having a senior police officer on hand to talk to the people who were demonstrating. And what the writers of the article, I'm afraid I haven't got it with me, so I can't remember their names, were saying is most riots start with some provocation. That's not to justify rioting. Rioting is obviously a dangerous and stupid activity. But most riots in Britain happen for a reason, as they did in Ireland. Most people, the grievances of the million people under the age of 24 with no hope of a job need to be addressed.
Okay, now last story, Watchdog Fury at EDF. We had a rather nasty story about them last week, spying on Greenpeace, who were trying to do a bit of research into this new nuclear reactor they want to put in Hinkley Power Station. They have a call centre meltdown, which is likely to result in massive fines. The regulator Ofgem is losing patience over the way French giant EDF Energy is handling a record number of complaints caused by a new system at its three call centres. According to the company's own figures reported to Ofgem, complaints for the 12 months from October the 1st last year soared by 35% to 708,000, with one in eight customers expressing dissatisfaction with the service. This sounds to me a little bit like a complete failure of EDF to deliver customer service, Ian.
And goes back to the previous story is what I was saying there. Customer service is going to be a big differentiator here, and so I would recommend that people prick up their ears to this and get on the comparison sites and see what they are getting for their money, because you want the customer service to be excellent if you do have a problem, and if they're letting people down, then switch. That's what we do.
Well, I mean, maybe this kind of information could be on the site. It says here, EDF receive 126.4 complaints per 100,000 customers, compared with just 55 for 100,000 by British Gas. EDF is now officially Britain's most complained about power company. The massive surge in complaints has been sparked by the new customer care service. Martin.
I think ultimately these kind of industries were nationalised in the first place for a reason. The idea that competition between a handful of oligopolistic companies is actually going to deliver for the economy at large is erroneous. And in places like Norway, they've never bothered to privatise these things.
Well, competition may have worked for the shareholders and for the bosses of those companies, though, mightn't it? Anyway, that's at the end of our news review. We're coming up to the Sky News at 6 now. Thanks very much to this week's guest, Labour councillor for Staple Hill, Ian Bolton. After the news, we hear from investigative journalist Laurie Flynn, who published a book, The Untouchables, in 2004, explaining why the Stephen Lawrence case was kicked in to the long grass.
BCFM News from the Sky News Centre.